13. Alexander Pope, about 250 years ago, had a saying which he called the Ninth Beatitude. And it was this: blessed is he who expects nothing, for he shall never be disappointed. Blessed is he who expects nothing, for he will never be disappointed. What a despairing view of hope. Cicero put it slightly differently: where there's life, there's hope. Where there's life, there's hope. Perhaps the great preacher and writer John Bunyan put it best: hope is never ill when faith is well. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze in a minute and my hankies are in my briefcase, so I'll try not to spray the front row if I do. Where there's life, there's hope, said Cicero, but Bunyan said, hope is never ill when faith is well. Psalm 13, on first reading, may seem to be melancholy. It may seem to be depressing, but actually it is a psalm of hope. The title? Well, it was David who wrote it, but we're not sure at what period in his life he wrote this psalm. The outline is quite simple. It divides into three. Verse 1 and 2, David expresses feelings of abandonment. In verses 3 and 4, he prays. He says, God, turn your face towards me, answer me. And in verses 5 to 6, he recovers his hope, his trust, his faith in God. He said, you've been good to me in the past, be good to me again in the future. The psalm, which is a song, a poem, in the Hebrew has a nice little breakdown. It's in three sections, three stanzas. And the first stanza has five lines. The second stanza has four lines. And the third stanza has three lines, although the NIV has made it four. But in the Hebrew, it's three. So it's a kind of a triangle, 5-4-3. Think of it as a mountain. And we're going to go from the valley to the mountaintop in our understanding. So section one, or the first stanza, in the deepest valley, verses 1 to 2. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? In the deepest valley. There's a story told of two aliens who visited planet Earth, and they decided to split up, look at the local customs, meet up and discuss their findings, share their knowledge. When they met up, the first alien said, I discovered a strange religious ceremony. I went to a large green-shaped field. He said, in the middle, there was a crater. Around the edges, several thousand people had come to worship. Then two priests walked to the centre of the rectangular angle area, and they hammered six spears into the ground, three at each end. Then 11 more priests walked out, clad in white robes. Then two high priests, wielding clubs, came to the centre. One of the other high priests started to throw a red orb at the ones with clubs. Wow, replied the alien. And what happened next? Next, said the first alien, it started to rain. Well, there are times, of course, not just at a cricket match, when everyone experienced rain. It pours. And if you've never been in that in life, times when it feels like it's raining, don't panic, it's on its way. It's going to happen. Because everyone in life experiences those times when the weather is negative. Known Christians experience difficulties, so do Christians. Shakespeare said, when sorrows come, they come not as single spies, but as whole battalions. Four reasons why the psalmist is in the deepest valley. Look at verse 1 to 2 again. First of all, the length of his trials makes him feel that God's abandoned him. How long? How long? How long? How long? Four times, he tells us, this is a long, drawn-out situation. And so the length of his trials makes him feel abandoned. Secondly, he feels he's forgotten because he no longer feels God's presence. Note the words of verse 1. How long will you hide your face from me? It's as if God's playing a heavenly game of hide and seek. And no matter how hard he looks, he can't find him. Verse 2, the third reason. He feels God has forgotten him because he's in mental turmoil. Note the words in verse 2. How long must I wrestle with my thoughts? Every day have sorrow in my heart. Doubt and depression have grabbed hold of his mind, and he cannot shake them off. And then the fourth reason he feels God has forgotten him. Verse 2. He's in physical turmoil. How long will my enemy triumph over me? We don't know who the enemy is, but he seems to be getting the upper hand. And physically, David feels that his life is in danger. So mentally, spiritually, emotionally, physically, in every way, his back is against the wall. And there seems to be no hope. What do you do in situations like that? Well, according to the psalmist here, you pray. You pray. And in verse 1 to 2, David is complaining. But in verse 3 to 4, we find David praying. Praying. Bringing God into the equation, into the situation. Why? Because that's our ultimate hope. A.C. Dixon wrote these words. When we depend upon organisations, we get what organisations can do. When we depend on education, we get what education can do. When we depend upon men and women, we get what men and women can do. When we depend on prayer, we get what God can do. And the psalmist is, if we use New Testament language, he's saying to God, God, build a hedge around me, a hedge of protection from these enemies. Hedge me in, wall me in, protect me. Let me know I'm not abandoned, I'm not alone. So the first stanza, the psalmist is in the valley, the deep, dark valley. The second stanza I'm going to call the ascent. Starting the ascent, verses 3 to 4. Look on me and answer, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. My enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. Now he's still struggling in this part of the psalm, but he started climbing the mountain of faith before him. He's not languishing in the valley. And did you notice his question has changed in verse 3 and 4 from verse 1 and 2? He stopped asking how long. Four times he asked it in verses 1 and 2. Doesn't ask it now. Now in verse 3, he asks for understanding. Give light to my eyes or I will sleep in death. We use a saying, don't we? Never get out of the train while it's in the tunnel. We often say it to people who are in difficult situations. Don't give up hope. There is light at the end of the tunnel. Now the pessimist says, I know it's an oncoming train. But the Christian says, no, there is hope. There is light. And maybe that's what the psalmist is saying here. He says, Lord, I'm in the tunnel and I'm looking for the light. I need a glimmer of light, of hope, to lift my spirit. And although he's crying in verses 3 to 4, it is not in self-pity. How long? I'm getting a bad deal here, God. It's not fair. Now it's constructive. Lord, give me light so that I can cope with the situation. And as we've mentioned in previous psalms like this, God never promises to prevent pain or tragedy or heartache. But he does promise to be with us in difficult times. Someone put it this way. I asked God to take away my bad habit. God said no. It's not for me to take away. It's for you to give up. I asked God to make my handicapped child whole. God said no. His spirit is whole. His body is only temporary. I asked God to grant me patience. God said no. Patience is a byproduct of tribulation. It is not granted. It is learnt. I asked God to give me happiness. God said, no. I give you blessings. Happiness is up to you. I asked God to spare me pain. God said, no. Suffering draws you apart from worldly cares and brings you close to me. I asked God to make my spirit grow. God said, no. You must grow on your own, but I will prune you and make you more fruitful. I asked God for all things that I might enjoy life. God said, no. I will give you life that you may enjoy all things. I asked God to help me love others as much as he loves me. God said, ah, finally, you have the idea. Well, if we're fortunate to live long enough, we will encounter difficulties. God has not promised to take them away, but to teach us and to shape us and to draw us closer to him through those difficulties. Now, we don't know whether God changed David's circumstances or not. What I believe is he changed David. May have taken him a day or two to write this psalm. He may have written it with hindsight after he'd learned his lesson. But there is a definite change in the middle of this psalm. And what changed? I doubt his circumstances did, but I think his awareness, his understanding, his appreciation of God changed. Third stanza, verses 5-6. The mountaintop. He starts in the valley. He makes the ascent, and now he's on the mountaintop. Verse 5-6. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord. Why? Because he has been good to me. A story told of a pastor who invited different church members out to the front. And he was going to use it as a kind of a testimony time to help folks understand God's goodness to them in different ways. He was talking on discouragement, and so he called up a number of people. He said, what is your favourite Bible verse? Share it with us. Well, one young man said, oh, it's easy, Psalm 23, verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, and I believe he's cared for me and guided me through my life. A middle-aged woman said, Psalm 46, verse 1. God is a refuge, a strength, an ever-present help in those times of trouble. And again, the congregation kind of amened, either quietly, because they were like this type of church, or out loud. Then the pastor called up old John, who was the oldest member of the congregation. This 92-year-old man came and he said, John, what is your favourite verse? And old John just said, it is, and it came to pass. And it came to pass. Well, some of the congregation started to giggle a little bit, thinking maybe old John's lost it. Some felt a little embarrassed for him. After all, he's standing on the platform, everyone's looking at him. Surely he could find a better verse than, and it came to pass. So the pastor said, tell us a bit more. And this is what old John said. 396 verses in the Bible say, and it came to pass. And how relevant they've been for my life. At age 30, I lost my job. We had 6 children to feed. I didn't know if we'd make it or not. At 40, my eldest son was killed overseas in the war. It shattered our family. At 50, our house burnt to the ground. Nothing was saved. We lost all our possessions. At 60, my wife of 40 years got cancer. It slowly ate away at her. We cried together many a night on our knees in prayer. At 65, she died. I still miss her today. The agony I went through in each of these situations was unbelievable. I wondered, where was God? But each time I looked in the Bible, I kept stumbling across one of those 396 verses that said, and it came to pass. He said, my testimony, God told me my pain, my circumstances would pass. And that God would get me through it. Well, David likewise, in verses 5-6, could say, it has passed, it has passed. We're now going from despair to delight. And David is saying, God, I may not have all the answers, but I will have all of you. I will trust in you. And I guess you notice as you've read the Bible that God's not very good at answering our questions, is he? A skeptic might say he gives you the politician's answer. You ask him one question and he gives you a different answer to the question you've asked. Job said, why? And God didn't answer. He just showed him who he was. Mary and Martha, why did you let my brother die? And Jesus said, well, I'm the resurrection. I'm the life. You trust me. God doesn't avoid the question deliberately, but perhaps we're not capable of grasping hold of the answer or appreciating it. Maybe the answer's too big for us to handle or not applicable. But notice what David does at the conclusion of this psalm. God gives him three things to grab hold of. Or perhaps he grabs three things as he trusts in the Lord. Verse 5. First of all, he trusts in God's unfailing love. But I trust in your unfailing love. Why is it unfailing? Because God is unfailing. Why is God's love dependable? Because God is dependable. It has to reflect him. Circumstances change. Good, bad, indifferent. People change. They may like us one week and dislike us the next. But God is constant. Always unfailing. Always dependable. He can't be anything else. And so David says, God, I don't understand the world I'm in. But I understand this about you. You never, ever change. And I'll hold on to that. Secondly, verse 5, he talks about God's salvation. My heart rejoices in your salvation. Now, salvation here does not mean salvation from sin, as often we think about it. Salvation means wholeness. In this context, it probably means being taken, rescued from my problems, from the difficult situation I found myself in. So it's more physical deliverance than spiritual deliverance. And again, the psalmist is saying, God, you have taken me through difficult times, and I can look back and praise you for it. And then thirdly, he holds on to God's goodness, verse 6. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. David is able to look back, and even out of the dark times, he can find goodness. Again, there's a New Testament equivalent, isn't there? All things work together for the good. Doesn't mean all things are good, but they work together for the good for those who trust him. Even out of our dark times, God can bring goodness. Those dark times are not necessarily of God, but God can use them for our benefit, for his glory. So in conclusion, verse 1 and 2, David is complaining. There is a time to complain. Bring our woes before the Lord. Verse 3 and 4, David is praying. That's perhaps what we all need to do in dark times. Verse 5 to 6, David is trusting and rejoicing. Why? Because at the start of the psalm, he's looking inward. And all he finds is a reason to moan and complain. And whenever we look within, we'll always find a good excuse to have a moan. But at the end of the psalm, he's looking upward. And he's now focused on the Lord. And he's able to give thanks and find strength and rejoice because he is focused in God. He's no longer dwelling in the dust. He's counting his blessings, both past and present. And he's reaching out to the God he follows. May that be our experience as well. Let's pray.